Hello, Tom. This is Paul Deaton with Blog for Iowa for our interview.
Hey, Paul.
Hi. Hope you're having a good day. You ready?
Yeah, sure.
All right, great. Well, congratulations on your forthcoming book, The Hidden History of American Democracy, Rediscovering Humanity's Ancient Way of Living.
Thank you.
I appreciate the opportunity to ask you a few questions about the book, so let's just get right into it. What inspired you to write this book?
I think that there are a lot of misperceptions about, what democracy is, how normal or natural is it? Is it some, you know, weird idea that some guy came up with 300 years ago, or is it something much, much larger than that? Number one. Number two, what the founders and the framers of the Constitution, the founders of the country and the framers of the Constitution thought about democracy, what they were trying to put into place. And number three, you know, what that has meant for us all these years and how we can improve or better strengthen our democracy. So, that was my goal in writing the book, basically, was to fill in those three areas.
All right. Is this going to be the final chapter in the Hidden History series?
I'm not sure. I'm having that conversation right now with my publisher.
Fair enough. So what do you hope readers take away from this book?
Well, there's a number of things. Number one, I think one of the myths about democracy is that it is an abnormal thing, that, it's the result of the cleverness of our human intellect and that we have to, work real, real, real hard, find just the right people to make it work, and that it's, an abnormal state, all that sort of thing. When I was looking into democracy, one of the studies I found was by a couple of scientists out of the UK, Kent Conrad and a fellow by the name of Roper. And they hypothesized that democracy is actually the main vehicle, the main instrument that is used in all animal species for decision making, or at least all social animal species. There are a handful of animals that live solitary lives, but all animals that have the interaction actually. And they published this about a decade and a half ago, and then there were some subsequent studies to see if to try and validate it. One of them was at the university where these guys were. There was a forest that had a herd of red deer. And so they put some cameras out there to watch them and see, how do they decide, for example, they're out grazing, when do they go to the water holes? And there's three water holes. How do they know which one to pick? And, the assumption was that there would be an alpha leader. This is something that is a common belief in our culture. It's a false belief that animal species have alpha animals that make all the decisions. And in fact, yes, there are alpha animals, and yes, they do have first choice of sexual mates, but that's the only decision that they have the power over the rest of the community with. And that, is kind of very Darwinian. It sort of makes sense. The strongest animals would have the genes to pass along to ensure survival of the species. But in all other regards, decisions are typically made democratically. So what they found was that when these red deer reached the point where it was, an appropriate time to go get a drink, that they would start pointing their bodies toward one of the three watering holes. And when 51% of them had pointed at one of the watering holes, the entire herd would just kind of form itself together and head off to the watering hole. So I interviewed Ken Conrad about that and said, what happened when you published this result in the peer-reviewed journal Nature? And he said, it was amazing. A fish guy, an ichthyologist, called me up and said, this accounts for schooling behavior. You see schools of fish, and they're swimming along, and then all of a sudden the entire school of fish just makes a left-hand turn. And I always thought they had to be telepathic or something. Same with birds and flocks. I mean, nobody's yelling, hey, turn left. But it turns out that what's going on is every motion of the body to, you know, every flap of the fins, as it were, or flap of the wings in the case of birds, is actually a vote. And when 50% plus one of the fish have, or the birds, have chosen to move in a certain direction, then the entire flock or the entire school makes a turn and goes in that direction. And he had a bug guy, an entomologist, call him up and say, yeah, we see the same thing with swarms of gnats. They're voting with every wing beat. You know, a guy who specialized in ants said, you know, we're seeing group decision-making with ants. Several primatologists contacted him and says, you know, basically we see this with all the apes. So it turns out that democracy is not, you know, some weird thing that somebody thought of 3,000 years ago in Greece or that the founders hatched, you know, a short while ago in Virginia, that it's built into us. It's part of our genetic code. It is at the core of virtually every animal species on Earth, including humanity. So, you know, that's something that makes me very optimistic about the future, even though there are, you know, some very real and substantial challenges, you know, to our democracy right now. So that's, you know, that's one of the takeaways that I wanted people to get.
All right. I certainly picked that up from the book, so that's it got through to me anyway.
Good. Another was the idea that our founders came up with this idea of democracy based on the Greeks and the Romans, and, you know, which makes it very kind of ethnocentric to, you know, white Europeans, basically. And it turns out that in the late 1600s and throughout the 1700s, the 18th century, there was this phenomenon in France called salons, where, you know, which still continues, but it was a big deal back then. I mean, there weren't movies or TV sets in people's houses. And it was mostly wealthy women. They would invite a featured speaker to come in and speak. And, you know, powerful, influential and wealthy people would come and listen. And sometimes there would be days of conversations afterwards at these salons. So at that time, this from the late 1600s through really the mid to late 1700s, the French had, here in North America, had really successfully penetrated most of Western New York and you know, what we would today call, you know, Michigan and Ohio. And the Huron, in particular, one of the tribes, allowed the French missionaries, principally this was French trading companies, they were, you know, trappers, they were looking for furs. They were also very heavy up in Canada. But the Huron allowed the missionaries to come and stay with them. And they taught the missionaries their language, and the missionaries taught them French. And these French missionaries started writing kind of an annual report back to France that was published for almost 70 years every year, that became, in the early 1700s, just a major sensation across Europe. And they were translated into multiple languages. And they were the stories of how these Native Americans were living really the life of Riley. They just had great lives. There was no police. There was no crime. There were no jails. There were no rich people, but there were no poor people. People got along. There was a virtual absence of warfare, and conflicts were resolved by playing games. Lacrosse was a principal one. You could have as many as 100,000 people from two or three tribes come out and play a lacrosse game to settle a border dispute, for example. And this became very, very popular in France in particular. A couple of these Native Americans who learned French, who became very, very fluent in French and were, you know, good speakers, were taken to France, you know, voluntarily and participated in these salons. And the people attending these salons included, you know, people like Hobbes and Locke and Diderot and Jean-Jacques Rousseau. And I mean, you know, the primary thinkers, Montaigne, the primary thinkers who were credited as being the inspiration to our founders for our democracy and our Constitution. And in fact, you know, Locke, you know, in his footnotes, and Hobbes in his footnotes reference these things. either the salons or the writings of these the French missionaries and the Native Americans. Because they would, you know, they'd come over to France and just challenge the idea of kings and kingdoms, challenge the idea of great wealth being accumulated in a small number of families, and, you know, point out its absurdity and how unhealthy it is and how destructive it is to quality of life. And why do you have all these poor people and, you know, all this kind of stuff? So it turns out that this came back to the United States by way of these Enlightenment era thinkers, but it originated with the Iroquois Confederacy. And Jefferson and Hamilton and Madison and Franklin in particular, and even John Adams, were not at all unaware of this. They entirely knew all this stuff. Jefferson's father was a map maker and traveled all over Virginia constantly, and his son traveled with him frequently. Peter Jefferson, Thomas's father, died when Thomas was 15. But they spoke multiple Native American languages. Peter did anyway, and the Native Americans, of course, were learning English and French quickly, and very often stayed in the Jefferson household. And Ben Franklin, for almost 30 years, was one of our principal intermediaries with multiple Native American tribes, and stayed with them, lived with them, worked with them briefly, lived with them, and. They understood that, in fact, you know, there's this famous letter from Ben Franklin around the time of the Constitution being drafted, when he said that, you know, if five nations of ignorant savages can forge a bond that has lasted in peace for over 1,000 years, then certainly 13 colonies of educated Englishmen can do the same. And he didn't mean ignorant savages as a slur. It was just, you know, how they referred to natives, Native Americans at the time. So the another story that I really wanted people to get is that this extraordinary American experiment is not really that much of an experiment, that through trial and error, Native Americans, and it turns out not just Native Americans, Native Africans, Native South Americans. There was just a piece last week published in Nature magazine, a peer-reviewed piece, about Mesoamerica and how this new amazing new archaeological research in Central America, finding that most of the communities in Central America were actually egalitarian and democratic. There's no evidence of great wealth, and there's no evidence of poverty in those communities. There were some communities like the Aztec and the Inca and smaller versions of them that were hierarchical and dictatorial. But the smaller communities, and some of them were very large, hundreds of thousands of people, big towns, that were run small-d democratically, were more resilient when it came to war, when it came to drought, when it came to disease. They were the last to fall. And so, you know, the founders were very clear about this, that this was a good idea. It's why in the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson wrote about nature's God. He said, you know, nature's God dictates that you know, we have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And, you know, John Adams was the first editor of the Declaration, and he scratched out nature's God and wrote in the Christian God. And then Jefferson got it back and scratched out the Christian God and put in nature's God, because, A, Jefferson was not a Christian. He was a deist, as was Franklin and as was George Washington. And, B, he really believed that nature and God were kind of the same thing. As deists, they believed that, you know, God created the universe way back when, and then everything has been operating according to natural law ever since. And nature and God are, you know, nature and the laws of nature are simply the implementation of the creator's will, period, full stop. You know, no sky god intervening in day-to-day events. And it's right there in the Declaration of Independence. So that's another big piece of it that I wanted to communicate to people, and I hope I did a good job of that.
Well, I picked up on all of that as I was reading the book. And I guess my question regarding that, I mean, here in Iowa, we have a lot of people, especially in the last few years, have believed that the United States was founded as a Christian nation, and as you describe in the book, it decidedly was not founded as Christian or affiliated with any religion. And so I wonder, from your perspective, are you seeing this elsewhere in the country, this resurgence of the Christian nation movement?
Yeah, there's a huge Christian nationalist movement, or Christo-fascist movement, I think is probably a more accurate description of it. It resembles the reinvention of the Christian church in Germany under Archbishop Müller by Hitler in 1936 or 7, in many ways. And it's ahistoric. You know, they make up quotes from the founders, or they cherry-pick quotes out of context. But you're absolutely right. The fact of the matter is that the founders wanted to keep this country as far away from religion as they possibly could. The Salem witch trials, which were not a singular event in American history, they were probably the most gaudy, the most ostentatious, the most high publicity of the events. But in Massachusetts, Massachusetts almost didn't get admitted to the Union because it was still being run as a semi-theocracy. There were still laws requiring you to pay taxes to the church and compulsory attendance at church and things like that. And they had to drop all those laws in order to become a state. So this was within the living memory of the people who wrote the Constitution, the destructive nature. It's why Ben Franklin fled Massachusetts when he was 17 years old, and he wrote about it in his autobiography and said, "I have absented the Christian assemblies and found them to be of no use," I think was the phrase he used. And, he was so offended by it, it's why he went to Philadelphia. So they were all very clear about this, even the Christians among them. James Madison, who was Jefferson's protege and was the father of the Constitution, kept all the notes and pretty much ran the Constitutional Convention that summer of 1787 in Philadelphia. Madison was a church-going Christian and an enthusiastic one. John Adams didn't just go to church. He would sometimes go to two or three church services on a Sunday, and he took notes. And both of those guys were outspoken in wanting to keep religion out of government. Now, from the Christian, although there was a Christo-fascist perspective at that time, it was principally represented by Patrick Henry. Patrick Henry wanted America to be a Christian nation, so he's one of the ones more commonly quoted as one of the founders, who had that idea. But he also refused to sign the Constitution. I mean, he didn't like it that we were not going to become a Christian nation. This is the guy who said, "Give me liberty or give me death," but was the largest slaveholder in the entire state of Virginia, and one of the most brutal, by the way. So, anyhow, Madison got in two different places in the Constitution, written in that there shall be no religious test and that freedom of religion shall prevail in the United States, and no religious test for office in the United States. And George Washington negotiated a treaty with the Muslims in the Barbary Coast that opens with the words, and I'm paraphrasing from memory, but something like, "As the United States of America is in no way founded on the Christian or any other religion, we have no enmity with the Mohammedans, with the Muslims." And that was signed by John Adams, but it was written and negotiated by George Washington. Jefferson, same thing. He was flipped out about the possibility that a church person, a Jerry Falwell type, might ever rise to become president or even a senator or member of the House. His protege, James Madison, who, as I said, was a Christian, was also very worried about this, although Jefferson was afraid what might happen if a religious figure gained political power. Madison was afraid of what might happen if government started giving money to churches and thus corrupted the Christianity that he loved. And so, Jefferson was president from 1801 to 1809, and Madison came into office in March of 1809. And Madison's first veto, there was a religious revival going on that decade, and Congress had changed the language on the bill that George Washington had signed to provide for a poorhouse in Washington, D.C., our first welfare program, which provided shelter, clothing, medical assistance, and food, and employment in some cases to poor people in Washington, D.C. And when Congress changed it and presented it to James Madison, it said that the money would be authorized to be given to a church in D.C. to run the poor homes. And Madison vetoed that and said this would set a terrible precedent. The federal government should never give money to any church under any circumstances. And it wasn't because he was afraid about the government. He was afraid that it would destroy his religion, his, you know, his beloved Christianity. So he and Jefferson had this, like, 20-year dialogue about which was worse, religious people in government or government sticking its nose in or helping out religion. And turns out they were both right.
Yeah.
They were both right. And they were both furious about, you know, Patrick Henry and others' attempts to Christianize America.
Well, I wanted to ask a question about the writing, and I was particularly stricken with the narrative about Thomas Jefferson and his youthful experiences with the Cherokee. That seemed particularly relevant to what you say. And you, earlier in this call, you mentioned that the salons in Europe and how people learned about this culture. But what struck me about that passage was that you almost didn't mention all the other narratives about Jefferson that are out there, which are countless, like being a slave owner, diplomat, farmer, intellectual, politician, and all those. And so I guess what I'd ask you is, how does this story about the Cherokee experience fit in with all these other narratives about Jefferson?
Well, he was a complex man, and he lived in a complex time. I think most people know who he was and what he was and have formed their own opinions about him. So I didn't see any value in engaging in that debate. There are entire books devoted to that, both pro and anti-Jefferson. I just wanted to point out that the guy who authored the Declaration of Independence, the guy who authored the Virginia Declaration of Religious Freedom, the guy who authored essentially the Bill of Rights, and without whom the Bill of Rights never would have been amended to the Constitution, and the guy who edited the first draft of the Constitution, was intimately familiar with the Native American democracy. And that's why that scene where he is there with Onoset, as Onoset is about to get on a boat and go over to England to negotiate. Now, this was, you know, in the 1740s or 50s, as Onoset is about to go over to England to negotiate with King George II, and Jefferson is like 17 years old, 18, 19, something like that in that scene. That it was a way of just kind of bringing alive the fact that these guys lived tooth and jaw, or cheek and jowl, with Native Americans in many cases. John Adams, in one of his letters, and I don't know if it made it into the book or not, there's a lot I wrote that ended up getting cut out, you know, to make it a smaller book. But Adams and Jefferson, in their correspondences, talked about the Indians that they knew as they were growing up and that they kept track of and were close to throughout their lives. And that was the point that I was trying to make.
Okay, fair enough. You wrote about what motivated the framers of the Constitution, how they hoped to create a better world by getting the foundational document and the new country it created right. I would ask you, what is the best chance to get that kind of motivation back into our society or back into our governance?
Well, the last third of the book, or quarter of the book, I don't recall if it was three or four pieces, is a list of things, policy things, that we can and should do, that none of which are particularly novel, but all are put in the frame of this, the larger frame of the book, which is that if we really believe in democracy, if we really believe that nature's God was right in wiring us to make our best decisions by majority or consensus or something in between those two, certainly at least by majority rule, then there's this whole list of things that Americans overwhelmingly want and have for decades that we don't have. And we don't have them because our democracy is quite imperfect. It has been badly corrupted by, in large part, by the Supreme Court ruling that people of great wealth, that their money is the same thing as free speech, and therefore they can pour unlimited money into politicians and political campaigns. But there is a long list of things that I think that we can do to make our democracy or our republic more functional and more in line with those original ideals. And frankly, you know, we don't have to bind ourselves to the original ideals, other than, you know, my pointing out that they are what nature, you know, they are what we're really actually wired for. You know, not the original ideal of slavery, although that was only embraced by, you know, a handful of states in the South, or half the states in the South. The states in the North wanted no part of it. So, bottom line, I think that this is my hope with the book, is by describing, you know, what democracy is, how it came about in the United States, that would provide us with a basis to have a reasonable conversation about, well, you know, does something like strengthening Social Security or having Medicare for all, you know, where does the commons begin and where does the commons end? How does that fit into how democracy works and what democracy is, or, you know, what the vision for America that the framers and founders had versus, you know, the vision for America the right-wing billionaires have right now?
All right. Wasn't given any time limit, but I assume about 30 minutes here. Are we okay on time?
Yeah, 30 minutes is great. Thank you, Paul.
All right. Let's see here. All right, so let me ask this question. You talked about Benjamin Franklin moving from Philadelphia. So the Media and Democracy Project is looking for an FCC hearing on whether Fox in Philadelphia is qualified to remain an FCC broadcast licensee based on their distortion of news. And do you believe Fox can be denied renewal? And is this a useful action, or have you heard of it? I assume you've heard of it.
No, I hadn't heard of it, but I know that there have been similar efforts over the years with other Fox stations. There was one down in Florida a decade or so ago. And, you know, Fox television stations are ultimately owned by the same parent company as Fox News, but it's completely different management from the top, from at least the second level down. So if they're going after the Fox television stations based on what Fox News is doing, I don't know how much success they'll have. On the other hand, if the Fox television stations in their local news broadcasts, or even in their national news broadcasts, are distorting the news, then yeah, by all means, people should be going after their licenses. I can't speak with a great deal of information to that. I haven't really studied it.
Okay, fair enough. One last question. Liberals and conservatives seem to have two irreconcilable ways of defining racism and what needs to be done about it. So how does humanity's ancient way of living address solutions to racism?
That's probably one of the toughest questions, you know, because throughout the course of early humanity, and David Graeber does a better job than me of that in his book, The Dawn of Everything, which is like a 600-page book. Mm-hmm. But it's like, you know, all this history going back 100,000 years of humanity. That, you know, typically, historically, people lived in tribes where everybody looked like them, everybody was related to them, and everybody spoke the same language. And one of the great experiments that we're trying right now in the United States, and that Europe is kind of putting its toe into, in some cases without success, is having a multiracial and, to some extent, even multicultural society that functions smoothly. And I think that, you know, the verdict appears to still be out about whether it's possible, although there are parts of America that give me great hope. But on the other hand, our schools are more segregated now than they were, you know, in the 1960s. Our, you know, many of our racial problems are not only very much with us, but have been exacerbated by, you know, the Republican Party's embrace of racial hate as a political strategy over these last 40 years, you know, since Nixon's Southern Strategy and Willie Horton ads and all the war on drugs and all this stuff. So I don't know. It's referred to as America's original sin. It's one of the toughest challenges as a nation that we face, and I don't have any easy solution for it other than to recognize and acknowledge our common humanity, to work when possible with the assistance of government to make our media, our educational system, in particular our universities, but also our public schools, as multiracial as possible. When people grow up with people who look different than them, or in some cases even speak differently than them, they grow up to be more tolerant. That's an important thing. I think it's one of the reasons why red states that are largely rural and white are so intolerant, is because they just don't know other people. They don't know people of color. They don't know, gay people or trans people. And so it's very easy to demonize people you don't know. And I have a lot of enthusiasm for this experiment, and I'm very optimistic that we're going to pull it off. But it's not going to be without hiccups along the way, as we've been seeing, for 5 centuries here in North America.
Well, thanks so much, Tom, for spending the time with me to answer our questions. I appreciate your writing and your radio and everything you do. I hope you have a great afternoon.
Well, thank you, Paul. Thanks for having me on. It's been great talking with you. Great questions. Thank you.
Okay. Bye.